This is the download of Sport and the British from the BBC. You can find the terms and conditions on our website at bbc.co.uk/radio4. Sport and the British is presented by Claire Balding.
So far in this series, we've examined how sport was played, governed, and enjoyed by spectators. But by the late 1920s, sport had the means of reaching out to a brand new audience, to millions around the country and ultimately around the world, thanks to what went on here at Broadcasting House.
Sport and the British. Broadcasting to the nation.
I've come to Portland Place in London, just north of Oxford Circus, because this building, with the front of it shaped like the hull of a ship, is the headquarters of the BBC. It was officially opened in 1932, 6 years after the first major sport was broadcast on the radio. And ever since then, sport has played a huge part in the history and development of broadcasting, and radio equally played a crucial role in the popularisation of sport. Suddenly you didn't need to be at the event to know exactly what had happened or to be caught up in the excitement. There had, until 1926, when the Derby at Epsom was carried live on the radio, been no such thing as the armchair fan. You were either at a sporting event in person or you read about it in the newspaper. Perhaps you might be able to watch highlights on Pathé News some days later. Live outside broadcasting brought the action right into the home, and it could follow the action as it happened. Jean Seaton is the BBC's historian.
That it chose to broadcast sports in itself was not inevitable. Not all countries broadcast sport as quickly as the BBC did. So that sense that sport was part of the British way of life, I think, was quite important, that it was part of the empire way of life. And a lot of the very early appointments to the BBC had been soldiers. They regarded sport as something which braced, you know, mankind in various kind of ways, and it was kind of exemplary. It was good for you. So in the 20s and 30s, they've already inherited some notion that sport is something which is not merely entertaining, but in some curious way, virtuous.
Sport fitted in nicely with the Reithian mission for the BBC to educate, inform and entertain. It also tied in with the ideal of the British gentleman, whose character was moulded by the rigours and the discipline of sport. The public school educated men who are now running the BBC believed in sport, both in terms of its appeal to the upper classes and its popularity with the working classes. At an amateur level at least, it was uncorrupted, unscripted, unifying drama, and it also took radio out of this, the controlled environment of the studio, and it took it somewhere else completely, where nothing could be scripted or predicted. The BBC could also buy sport cheaply, and it provided hours of entertainment. It worked for them, and it worked for their audiences in the new medium of live outside broadcasting. Sport also provided regular action every week and every month. It gave a structure to the year, as Jean Seaton explains.
Sporting events of all sorts of kinds calendared British social life, both upper class life. In Ascot, the season ends at the end of it. The season begins with shooting. It calendared working class life, that football matches were very accessible and very cheap. You went in the winter. So there is a calendar of sports which is already vividly part of British social life across all the classes. What's really interesting is that it puts all these calendars together and makes us all participate in the same calendar. And the Oxford and Cambridge boating race was mainly attended by Oxford and Cambridge people, and suddenly it became a British event, something that everybody could take sides in. You might say what's very interesting is the bits of the sporting calendar that it doesn't pick up. So let's look at birds. For the upper classes, you don't get shooting them. For the working classes, you don't get pigeon racing. Very important sport in the 1930s and 40s. So this BBC calendar makes its own choices, which is acceptable to everybody.
But they didn't always get it quite right. A flavour of the public school-inspired amateur programming of the early years comes out in a complaint to the BBC from Stanley Rouse, Secretary of the Football Association. He wrote to Gerald Cock, head of Outside Broadcasts, in 1935 to complain that the amateur football international between England and Scotland, played at Dulwich, had been omitted from the news.
In the second item on Saturday the 24th of March, there was a 5-minute account of varsity sport and 3 minutes on the Army versus RAF rugby game. Neither has the same public appeal as amateur soccer.
It would be hard now to think of a sports bulletin in which football isn't the lead item, let alone not mentioned at all. As for the live coverage of sport, that can only come alive with good commentary, and for that, you need a good story, you need compelling characters, and you need the natural rise and fall of excitement, a peak at a goal, a try or a wicket, the gradual crescendo of a race reaching its climax, the thrill of the knockout. There's an operatic quality to the best of radio sports broadcasting, and it can bring huge pleasure, whether the listener is an expert or a complete novice. The novelist Winifred Holtby, author of South Riding, wrote the following letter to the Radio Times in 1930.
I was excited. I had not, to this day, the remotest notion of what they were doing, but I know that I was excited. No one could listen with cold blood and sluggish pulses to the quickening of the roar preceding the final shout of goal. I wanted more goals. I didn't care who shot them. I didn't know who shot them. I didn't know who was playing or what or where or why, but I wanted to feel my spine tingle and my pulses beat as that voice cried out from somewhere near our drawing-room curtains.
Brilliant piece of work. Weddle's going through. By Jove, he can get round his men. No, he won't. And Marshall, falling back, crashes the ball out of play.
Eight.
Oh, dear. Barnett, making doubly sure that no time shall be lost. Oh, it's another goal. No, he can't. By Jove, well done. Well done, Gil Fillon.
George By Jove Allison, commentating on the 1934 Cup final. You may also have noticed another voice shouting, Eight! This was to help listeners to follow the progress of the ball by means of a grid that was printed in the Radio Times. So it needed two commentators, one for player identification and for colour, and the other telling you where the ball was. In charge of the original sports programming was the debonair-sounding Seymour Jolly de la Binière, who was appointed as director of BBC Outside Broadcasts in 1935. He was old school through and through. And he was responsible for employing some of the greatest names in the history of broadcasting.
It was a remarkable period because there was a collection of people of quite extraordinary personality as well as capability, all under the control, and I use the word advisedly, of the great Simon de Lobinier, who was head of Outside Broadcast, and literally invented the technique of outside broadcasting.
Raymond Baxter remembering Lobby. But sport also showcased provincial accents. Jean Seaton again.
You did begin to get a series of local, regional voices. And in particular, I suppose one of the ones that certainly lasted right into my childhood was John Arlott. And that was a wonderful, rich voice that started off in the northwestern region, started a career there and moved into the centre.
The British have a peculiar fondness for speech radio, and part of that is down to the sporting content offered in those early years. The 1948 Olympics, coming so soon after the end of the Second World War, was a chance for the nation as a whole to enjoy the unity and the relative harmlessness of sport. Improvements in technology combined with the commitment of the BBC meant that the Olympics could be broadcast on a scale never before seen. There were 40 recording studios, 200 foreign correspondents, 32 commentators' positions in Wembley Stadium alone. Radio had sport covered. The BBC chose the sports that its leaders judged to reflect the best interests of the public, and in return, it got hours of live broadcasting at a very agreeable rate. A secular sporting calendar gave shape to the year, and it still does. Six Nations rugby marks the end of winter. The boat race and the Cheltenham Festival, the start of spring. The FA Cup is that transition period between spring and summer. And then we get into a feast of test matches, Royal Ascot, Wimbledon and the Open Golf. They have a regularity that is comforting, but they still have the unpredictability of outcome that is the essence of all good drama. With the advent of television came, to use a sporting analogy, a whole new ball game. And a ball game that moved apace as independent companies realised the value of sport and the price that could be charged for exclusive access to live events. We'll examine the history of television sport in a later programme, but for all that jazz, never forget that radio sport came first.
Thank you for downloading Sport and the British from the BBC.